This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Is the municipal bond market the next financial shoe to drop?
And economic growth gets a third quarter bump.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, December 22nd. Coming up, people of developing nations seem to be a little happier about 2011. How you can tell a green gift from getting greenwashed. Later, if you put the financial crisis to music, what would it sound like? You'll hear what one composer thinks.
But first, we know just by sheer adding and subtracting, local governments are in trouble. The question is, how much? Financial analyst Meredith Whitney says that could very well lead to another economic crisis. Whitney made her reputation by seeing trouble with big investment banks before they collapsed. But could she be right again? Marketplace's Eve Troe is here in the studio with us with more. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
So what is Meredith Whitney predicting?
Well, she sees cities and towns failing next year the way big banks failed a couple of years ago. Local governments have seen a huge drop in tax revenue, largely due to unemployment. Dozens of municipalities are already failing to pay their pensions or even just pay their employees, people like ambulance drivers and police. And here's where the predictions come in. She says we'll see 50 to 100 local governments fail to make good on hundreds of billions of dollars in bonds. Here's how she characterized that impending crisis on 60 Minutes recently.
It has tentacles as wide as anything I've seen. I think next to housing, this is the single most important issue in the United States and certainly the largest threat to the U.S. economy.
But Eve, there are a lot of analysts saying that the predictions are pretty greatly exaggerated. Why?
Well, no one doubts that local governments are in trouble, but there are grumblings on whether things are as dire as Whitney says. And that's because her numbers are not transparent. She released a study for her clients, but they want to see more. You know, more municipalities have defaulted on bonds in recent years, but the worst year on record was $8 billion. So to get to hundreds of billions from $8 billion, that would necessitate a staggering change.
That's a big jump. All right. Marketplace's Eve Troe reporting live from here in Los Angeles. Eve, thanks.
Thanks.
U.S. gross domestic product grew 2.6% in the third quarter. That's a bit higher than originally thought. GDP is a measure of all the goods and services the country produces. It's considered the economic indicator. Here to help us make sense of this is economist Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group in Boston. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So 2.6%, is that number making you happy?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, this is about the most normal, unexciting figure you can imagine. It is not good. It is not bad. It is perfectly in the middle. Let me put that in perspective a couple of ways. The 1990s, which were a pretty good decade, saw GDP growth of 3.3% over the 10-year period. The last decade, which was not so good, showed GDP growth of 1.7%. So this 2.6 number is right in between those two. And really represents what most economists now believe is perfectly consistent with our economy's long-term potential. In other words, people are constantly coming into the labor market looking for jobs. If we grow an economy at 2.6%, we will just be growing fast enough to absorb those new labor market entrants. And in other words, hold the unemployment rate stable at whatever its level is.
Okay. Well, will 2.6% growth be enough to pull us out of this recession?
Well, first point is we are technically out of the recession.
Oh, this is true. This is true.
This is true. Yeah, the high priests of economics in Cambridge, Massachusetts have deemed the recession to have ended about a year and a half ago, the summer of 2009. So we've been out of it almost a year and a half. Unfortunately, you know, for most Americans, it doesn't feel like we're out of the recession because most people judge their economy's performance based on the unemployment rate, which remains very lofty. So we're going to have to do much better than 2.6% in order to get this 9.8% jobless rate moving back down in the vicinity of 5 or 6%, which most people consider normal.
Economist Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group, thank you.
My pleasure.
The number of foreclosures in this country has grown to levels we haven't seen in recent years. A lot of homeowners couldn't pay for houses they thought they could afford, or as critics charge, they couldn't afford and should have never been given those loans in the first place. The fact of the matter is a lot of people are being forced from their homes, yet some of them are being kicked out wrongfully, even illegally. Today's New York Times reports on some bank foreclosure procedures that underscore what lawyers say is a fundamentally flawed foreclosure system. Andrew Martin is a reporter for The Times. He joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are banks making these mistakes, these illegal people getting kicked out of their homes illegally?
Well, you know, as I point out in my article, I think a lot of these instances center around whether or not the house is abandoned. In most mortgages, there's a clause that allows banks, when a payment is late and the house is abandoned, to go in and change the locks and, you know, secure the place so that the pipes don't break or vandals don't get in. So in many of these instances, it's second homes. It's people that are away for vacations for a long time. In one instance, it was a man who was in the hospital for months at a time. And the bank sends out crew who look in the window and say, hey, no one's here. We're going in.
How hard is it, Andrew, to identify the number of homeowners who have been locked out illegally?
Well, it's almost impossible, really, because you're talking about lawsuits that are filed at counties around the country. There's no sort of central database. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, not all the people that are in this situation file a lawsuit. The banks say it's very small. Consumer lawyers say they're underestimating the problem.
That it's a growing problem?
A growing problem, yes.
So what's the relief here? What can people do if this happens to them? I mean, obviously sue, but does the government do anything? What can be done?
Well, I think really, the answer is, one, if you're away for a long time, make sure you keep your house up and maybe let the bank know that you're leaving. But, lawsuits really are your only form of relief if, in fact, you have a legitimate claim.
All right. Andrew Martin, a reporter for The New York Times, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, the 22nd of December. Happy holidays. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Happy holidays, Steve. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
The German financial giant Deutsche Bank has agreed to pay more than $500 million to settle a tax evasion case here in the United States. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from our bureau in London with that story. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So we're talking about clients here. Which ones and when was this going on?
Well, they were clients of accounting firm KPMG, and back in the 1990s, KPMG, with Deutsche Bank's help, sold these people illegal tax shelter schemes. KPMG has paid almost $500 million in fines already for this. Now it's Deutsche Bank's turn.
What kind of scale are we talking about, Stephen? How big a deal is this?
Oh, huge. I mean, Deutsche Bank has admitted involvement in at least 1,300 dodgy deals. It's reckoned that U.S. citizens, as a result, evaded almost $6 billion in taxes. Most of that money has now been recovered from the taxpayers concerned.
Does this settlement close the book on these tax evasion stories?
Well, I've been talking to somebody called Richard Murphy, who runs an anti-tax evasion group here, and he says we've probably seen the end of these really big, blatantly unlawful schemes sold by big banks and accounting firms. And certainly Deutsche Bank is likely to keep its nose clean for the foreseeable future.
I think $553 million, which I suspect is the biggest ever fine imposed with regard to a tax case in the world, is some significant measure of deterrence, even for a bank as big as Deutsche Bank.
But he concedes, like death and taxes, some form of tax evasion is inevitable.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
There's a new global survey that shows even the world's richest economies don't necessarily feature the planet's happiest people. The research looked at 53 countries around the world, and the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports there could be a connection between where a place is going and where it's been.
The joint Gallup International and Wind poll asked 64,000 people how optimistic they feel about next year. Things like personal well-being, job security, and how well the economy will fare. People who live in wealthy countries like the USA, Germany, the UK and Japan are markedly more gloomy than those in the economic powerhouses of the future, including India and Russia. Bronwyn Curtis is the head of global research at HSBC and says it's all got to do with your outlook.
We're thinking growth doesn't look good, the tax man's going to take more of it, and so you're not as happy. Whereas if you're sitting in China, which is growing at 8 or 9 or 10%, then of course you see the prospects are much brighter.
And that's reflected in some of the striking differences. Just 3% of French people interviewed thought 2011 would be prosperous, compared to more than half of people asked in China. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
This holiday, stores are full of bright new gadgets and soft sweaters and shiny jewelry. And then there are some gifts for your eco-minded friends. Marketplace's Adrian Hill now from the Sustainability Desk. And how to spot green from getting green washed.
I'm here at the Century City Mall in Los Angeles with Jessica Lass from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Hi there.
Hi, and we're here at this mall where they're encouraging us to buy our way into happy holidays. The question is, can we do that and stay green? What do you think?
I think there are possibilities out there, but definitely buyer beware on a few items.
Let's go see what we find.
Okay.
We spot a lot of clothes made in China, a lot of plastic toys, not a lot that would count as green. The rhinestone Hello Kitty, you think?
You know, probably not.
Some companies try to help out eco-minded shoppers by slapping green labels on products. At the Origins counter, they're selling plastic water bottles and are promising to plant a tree. But Lass wonders, where are they planting those trees? Is the plastic safe for drinking out of? Will it last? Actual green shopping requires a whole lot of questions and skepticism of environmental claims. Some of them don't mean what you think they do and are rarely enforced.
So it's important when you see language that appears to be loose.
Scott McDougall heads TerraChoice, a group that released a report called The Sins of Greenwashing.
To see if the manufacturer, the marketer, or the store is providing a good explanation of exactly what they mean.
The word eco, McDougall points out, describes our ecology, which includes things like oil and petroleum.
Natural is a good example. There are plenty of things that are natural that aren't necessarily good for us. Arsenic and lead and cyanide and mercury are all natural.
The important thing, he says, is to dig into the green claims. Don't dismiss them. Seek them out, but try to understand them better. Back at the mall, Jessica Lass comes up with another way to give green that doesn't require as much investigation.
I mean, you can take a friend out for dinner and spend a few hours catching up, reminiscing about the year, or really just, you know, sharing your time with them.
Sounds a little nicer than fighting crowds at the mall. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
By the way, we've got some green and not-so-green gifts at our website, marketplace.org. And whatever kind of gift it may be, British people could very well sneak a peek at it before Christmas. Have you heard about this, Stacey?
No.
This is a new poll. The website insurastore.com reports 37% of Brits have admitted to searching for, and this is the funniest part, and even opening at least some of their holiday presents before they're supposed to. They actually unwrap the gifts.
Huh.
But a similar survey out a couple of weeks ago here in the United States reported only 14% of Americans claiming to have gone all Sherlock Holmes.
Well, clearly we've got more self-discipline than the Brits. That's that's what I'm thinking.
I'm thinking here are a couple of things going through my head, right? A couple of things. Either Brits are more curious or Americans are less truthful.
No. No, what if Americans are just have more self-discipline?
There you go.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, December 22nd. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're about to say Happy New Year in just a little more than a week. But first, we say Happy Birthday to the Baby Boom generation. The first wave of boomers born in 1946 will start turning 65 in the coming year. But you shouldn't necessarily read retirement into that number. Today, the AARP released a report gauging how boomers feel about retirement. Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports many plan to keep on working, some because they have to, some simply because they want to.
The AARP figures about 7,000 baby boomers will turn 65 each day in the year ahead, and its new survey finds almost a third expect to retire at age 70 or later. 4 in 10 say they plan to work till they drop. AARP Executive VP Steve Cohn says this could end up easing the burden on Uncle Sam.
The longer baby boomers work, the longer it takes them to tap into Social Security. Probably that's a good thing for the system.
But where does the trend leave up-and-coming workers? At the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, Professor Olivia Mitchell says there's a widespread but mistaken belief that older people need to make way for younger workers. Actually, she says, employers end up hiring fewer workers if they're forced to help bear the cost of benefits for people who retire earlier.
The taxes that have to be raised to support them, number one, are very high, and number two, discourage the young folks from working hard because there's very little return to their efforts.
Besides which, those baby boomers will also create new jobs because somebody still needs to take care of them all. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So, Steve, I have to ask, have you done your Christmas shopping?
No, I'm not even close to being finished, so forget about that.
That's good to hear because I'm in the same exact boat. And you know, we are not alone. U.S. shoppers are procrastinating this year like never before. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Retail sales have been pretty good this season so far. It's strange, though, that we seem to be spending again, given that unemployment is basically worse and personal income is flat. Why, since the economy's, you know, basically where it was last year, is consumer spending up so much this season?
Retail sales are up, surprisingly up. In fact, a lot of economists are now recrunching their numbers because they hadn't expected consumers to turn out in force like this. The first thing I conclude is that, well, people are just tired of being miserable. People have finally said, all right, that's it. I don't want to be gloomy Gus all the time. I'm going to go out and treat myself a little bit, and this is the season for doing that.
Like frugality fatigue.
Exactly. But here's the other interesting data point. About half of all Americans have put off their Christmas shopping until this week. And I know that we're a nation of procrastinators. So the fact that so many people have put it off tells me that we've also become savvier shoppers as we've come through this downturn, because people know that it's a game of chicken with retailers. And the longer you wait, the chances of you getting a deep discount on that thing you want is going to happen.
I know that you do a lot of kind of on-the-ground consumer watching. Is there anything that you've noticed this season just observing at malls, shopping centers, things like that?
Yeah, I would say that people are getting a little learier of these extended warranties that get pushed on people. I mean, the businesses have been very aggressive with that, and there's a good reason for that. There's an 80% profit margin, at least that's what the experts tell me, for these extended warranties.
I know that at some stores they're offering them for small things like headphones, everything they'll offer you. I bought a mouse. They tried to sell me an extended warranty on a mouse.
It's nothing but gravy. And my advice to people is don't bother, because here's an interesting thing. Consumer Reports tells me that the median cost for the typical warranty almost matches, dollar for dollar, the median cost of the typical repair of that same product.
Well, David, thanks as always for joining us. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thanks so much, David.
Ho, ho, ho.
You know, Stacey, for me, when it comes to shopping, it's finding the time and the patience.
And the parking spot.
And the parking spot, too. That's right. For a lot of other people, it's about waiting for the better deal. Are retailers likely to oblige? Here's Marketplace's Elisa Roth.
All the good sales used to be after Christmas. Then the financial crisis happened, and stores got desperate. So they started having sales before Christmas. And now some shoppers wait as long as they can, hoping they'll get bigger and better discounts. Marshall Cohn is a retail analyst at the NPD Group. He says it's not going to happen.
You're going to get 50 off on selected items and categories within the store, but not necessarily store-wide.
There were some big sales early on, around Thanksgiving, but the retail business has been doing much better this holiday season. John Long is a retail analyst at Kurt Salmon Associates. He says that changes everything for stores.
They've really managed inventories a lot better this year, and so there is a lot less obsolete inventory that they're going to be faced with trying to clear out in the early spring months.
Which isn't to say there won't be deals come January, especially on seasonal things like sweaters. But if you've been waiting until Christmas Eve in the hopes of some door-busting bargains, you might as well get on with it already. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
And finally, have you ever wondered what a recession sounds like? The London Philharmonic's composer in residence has written a musical interpretation of the financial crisis. Could call it Ode on a Mortgage-Backed Security or
Bear Market Blues? I don't know.
Was that an Eric Clapton song? No, that
I think it should be. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.